It's not a giant mountain of fuel that's only there to destroy life and property. This drumbeat on the front page of the newspaper, we've got to do something about this evil chaparral. This is where the fires are going to be because it hasn't burned in 30 years. You know, why not make those areas, instead of highlighting them as places of hazardous vegetation, why not say, you know what, these are hazardous development areas. Let's stop putting houses out there. Instead of looking at this like a vegetation issue, sit back and look at the whole picture.
Good morning, I'm Tommy Howe, and welcome to another edition of Tree Huggers International on KBZT FM 94.9, a weekly natural science and environmental affairs program for the listeners of FM 94.9 and San Diego and all of Southern California, from the beaches to the mountains to the deserts. This is Tree Huggers International. Be careful and use this show with caution, because you might just learn something. Next time you take a road trip somewhere in this part of the state, maybe into the backcountry somewhere, whether it's inland or along the coast, take a few extra minutes to stop and appreciate the native plant community we have right here in Southern California. Chaparral. If you spend some time with it, you begin to realize it's made up of a great variety of plants, not just one monotonous blanket of green and gray along the hillsides and coastal bluffs, and it represents habitat for a great variety of animals and critters, a habitat that is rapidly vanishing from Southern California. Increasing development in chaparral-covered areas on the edge of Southern California cities and frequent, repeated fires don't give native plant species time to bounce back. Coupled with poor land management decisions, our native chaparral communities here in the Golden State are not just being strangled, they're slowly being destroyed at a rate faster than nature can repair itself. So joining us once again today on the program is our friend Rick Halsey, an expert on the chaparral community and Mediterranean climate in Southern California. Rick is the director of the California Chaparral Institute in Escondido and a member of the San Diego Regional Fire Safety Forum. Rick is also a Type 2 wildland firefighter and the author of Fire, Chaparral, and Survival in Southern California from Sunbelt Publications, now in its second edition. Rick, welcome back to Tree Huggers International. Good to have you back on the show.
Thank you, Tommy. Thanks for having me on.
We've got so much to talk about today, and I want to talk about a revealing road trip you just took up into the Cleveland National Forest. But first, let's talk about the San Diego Regional Fire Safety Forum. When you were here last time, the forum was still in the process of putting a report together on the October 2007 fires and some general recommendations. It came out last spring, but can you start from the beginning of how the forum came together and how the report came about?
Well, it was basically an assemblage of people, not directly employed anymore because they're retired or they've gone to other careers with the fire service, but people that really know the business. Chief Bowman, the retired firefighter from fire chief from San Diego City Fire, and a bunch of really well-respected firefighters themselves, also policy analysts, and some citizens were concerned. And what was important was, in order to get a really objective, this isn't going to impact my job, so I can't say this kind of thing, report, we got together and we developed a bunch of objectives that we felt were well-rounded and could solve the wildfire crisis, if you want to call it that, in San Diego County, by looking at the whole equation. So it's not just about the vegetation. It's just not about building codes. It's about all these things. Taking care of our firefighters, having enough firefighters, having the proper equipment, looking at vegetation as something we can adapt to rather than forcing it to adapt to us. So it's a whole equation. And the problem is, currently the approach has been, let's just go at the cheapest, most expedient way to deal with this. Let's not get more firefighters. Let's not get more equipment. Let's go ahead and just destroy the landscape, because after all, that's where the fires start. And so it's a very short-sighted viewpoint that'll essentially not do much to prevent wildfires. It'll just perpetuate the problems we're having already today.
So the report eventually came out, and it really got a lot of press when that came out. I mean, that wound up being in USA Today, a couple of national magazines. Can you talk a little bit about the response you got? Has it been positive? Has it been negative? Have you gotten any other folks in policymaking areas to listen?
A lot of the people in the fire service and folks that are outside the county have really said a lot of great things about the report. But we went to a lot of meetings with the Board of Supervisors and the subcommittee that Ron Roberts headed to try to impress upon them this holistic approach in order to deal with it. And unfortunately, they rejected pretty much all of our recommendations, other than improving some of the aerial firefighting components, which is the flashy, newsworthy,
it's the sexy kind of, part.
Yes, approach. And what they didn't attend to was what really is our number one recommendation, and that's to have a well-funded, coordinated, countywide fire department. We're the only big countywide entity in this state that doesn't have something like that, is subjected to an environment that frankly has the most dangerous fire-prone environment in the state, if not in the country. So the approach has been now is to put this Prop A on the ballot coming up, which will essentially give a parcel tax to everybody in the county for $52 a year, and that'll raise about $50 million. $25 million are going to go to this county something or other. We're not quite sure what it is because it was never specified in the proposition, and $25 million will go to various fire agencies. So the problem with that is it's going to take at a minimum about $125 million to really start the beginning a year, a sound countywide fire department. $25 million is not going to cut it. And the problem is this is so poorly presented to the public. Taxpayers are not going to be able to figure out how this money is being spent. Is it going to be spent to create a stronger fire service as far as more firefighters? Is it going to put another station near my house? It doesn't specify any of that. It just basically says, you trust us, taxpayers, and we'll spend it the way we feel. That's not the way to approach it. And so consequently, it doesn't look like this thing's going to pass. And that'll give cover, perhaps, maybe that's the whole intent, to the county board saying, well, look, we tried and you people voted it down once again. There's got to be some leadership to help the taxpayers and the voters understand that we've got to have a well-funded county fire department. It's got to be a guaranteed, sustainable source of revenue. And that can be raised in a combination of parcel taxes, sales taxes. It can't go up and down based upon people's whims, because you've got to have a guaranteed funding source. And the problem now is there just isn't any. And the county got out of the fire business after Prop 13. The other counties, fortunately, were able to assemble their wits and come up with a plan to create countywide fire departments. And so at the present moment, there just isn't a funding source. And with this thing that's going to go down probably in November, I can't predict the future, but just based on the current economic situation, I just don't see it passing.
The County Board of Supervisors was also talking about doing some kind of prescribed burns. Can you talk a little bit about what they were proposing and where in the county they were talking about doing these burns, and was this a good idea or not?
Well, Supervisor Bill Horn put up a map on the screen at the County Board of Supervisors dais there and showed some red splotches of areas that he says, well, this hasn't burned in a long time, and that's where next fire is going to be. So what he proposed to do was basically to burn it in rapid succession in a checkerboard pattern to eliminate this evil source of the wildfires. So the approach to that, once again, is very narrow-minded. It doesn't look at the big picture. None of the homes in the Witch Creek fire were impacted by flame impingement. Now, what that means is flames weren't licking up against buildings from this evil chaparral that some folks want to get rid of. Most of these homes, if not all of them, were burned down because of embers from the palm fronds in people's backyards, from the oleanders, from the eucalyptus, from a number of things. Yes, the fire came through the native vegetation, but if you want to preserve lives, if you want to save structures, where do you do it? The biggest bang for your buck is not squirreling out there in the backcountry trying to destroy the environment, which is what this proposal is really looking at. It's creating fire-safe communities, fire-literate population, and making sure that these communities can withstand a firestorm. Because right now, the San Pasqual Valley, which is where Highway 78 goes up to Ramona, it is so chock full of weeds and grass right now. Tomorrow, there could be a fire faster than the Witch Creek fire a year ago, because these fine fuels can carry fire a lot quicker and a lot more rapidly up canyons. And you could have just as many homes devastated in that fire as you did last year. Well, that's a fire that happened a year ago, and already we have more vegetation out there that's ready to burn? Yes, and that's the problem with these prescribed burn plans that Supervisor Horn and some of the other ones want to promote. It's going to replace one vegetation type with another that's frankly more flammable. It'll burn every single year, and this is the problem you have in the area around Palm Springs and in the San Bernardino Mountains, some of these areas burn twice a year. The fire that killed five firefighters in the U.S. Forest Service in 06 started in that kind of environment, grassy, weedy environment, went roaring up that hill. So again, this myopic viewpoint of the vegetation, if you're going to have expenditures, why don't you spend it where it's going to count? And it's going to count right there where we're living, not 5 miles out in the backcountry.
And it's worth noting, again, that a lot of these grasses and a lot of these other plant types that tend to burn come about as a result of the native vegetation being burned away.
Being destroyed, yes.
And over time, if given time to recover, eventually a lot of the native plants, would they come back? Would the chaparral plants come back? Or did the grasses kind of crowd it out?
We don't know what would happen, but it doesn't really matter because these areas continually burn over and over. 70,000 acres of the land that was burned in 07 had burned in 03. That's about 20%. That wasn't supposed to happen. Those areas now, about 60,000 of that was basically chaparral and shrublands. That's under threat of being eliminated and being replaced by these weeds. So I don't know what kind of fires they're talking about that they're going to prevent with these prescribed burns, but it certainly didn't help in 07. Now, I'm not saying that a chaparral fire is not a dangerous event that's not more intense than a grass or weedy fire. The point is, if you're trying to protect communities, fuel is fuel, and if you have grasses or chaparral, you're still going to have a fire carried through there. Yes, grassy fires are more easier to control, but that's also where a lot of firefighters get killed because they underestimate the potential, and they can still create a lot of damage.
Would it be safe to say that a lot of these prescribed burn models that the County Board of Supervisors may be taking are more based on this forest model, where if you have a burn that burns the understory and not the crowns, that's actually a very good thing for the forest. It cleans things out, so to speak. Are they almost applying that to chaparral? Aside from the fact that it's in the backcountry and it's not even near any communities, are they potentially just applying this model to chaparral?
Yes, they're doing that. And Bill Horn continually brings up this whole Baja California thing, where he said at the last meeting on the 24th of September, Baja doesn't have any problem because they continually allow fires to burn. You know, that is not an option for Southern California. The fire service nor the citizens would not tolerate allowing fires to continue to run. Fires kill people. They burn houses down. That's why we have a fire department, is to protect people. And they're not going to say, oh, let's let this fire run until, oops, it gets to Sally's house. We've got to jump on these things right now. So it is not an option to let these things run. And what happens in Baja, first of all, we don't really know. There's not a lot of records involved. And the study that has been used over and over to justify that approach is based on some flawed data. And we don't really have an understanding of what goes on, other than the fact that a lot of the Baja landscapes that they're talking about have been destroyed as far as native habitat. And I don't know if people, even the ones who'd like to eliminate chaparral, really understand what we're talking about. The backcountry in San Diego County really has some remarkable, beautiful natural vistas. It's really a beautiful place. And I don't really think people who are promoting these ideas understand that if you continually burn the backcountry like they're suggesting, you're going to eliminate all the green shrubbery and you're going to replace it with weeds, and that will have a large number of negative consequences that people don't even comprehend yet.
And the problem just compounds itself.
Yes, and it just compounds itself.
And that native vegetation, the chaparral, you could argue it cools the air.
It modifies the local climate conditions, absolutely. You remove all that shrubbery, which is what will happen if they continue to prescribe burn in the manner that they're talking about, and replace it with weeds, there's no doubt that the temperatures will go up, you'll change the local climates, and we've already got a problem globally anyway with that issue. The water table will not be recharged. We've got a water problem already. Erosion will continue. You've already got massive problems with runoff as it is. So you're complicating a lot of issues that are going to cost billions of dollars to try to correct, to deal with one issue that's not even approaching it in a full holistic manner.
Where are we right now with this matter with the Board of Supervisors? Are they going to start doing these prescribed burns anytime soon, or is this still on the shelf?
Well, the Planning Commission is going to take this up shortly, and they're going to put together a subcommittee that's going to look at this. We've got 180 days to come up with a comprehensive report. The Board of Supervisors expressed a lot of impatience with that. Why do we need 180 days? We need to do something now. Well, we are doing something now. There's already a lot of vegetation management going on. This report basically will be a manifesto, if you want to call it that will say, here's the whole enchilada. here's how you look at it scientifically, not emotionally. Here's the best way to apply the money that you have to reduce loss of life and loss of property, and at the same time preserve the natural environment.
You went to school in Santa Barbara,
right?
So you're familiar with the Central Coast. And obviously California has already had a very, very rough year with fire. And I hate to keep going back to fire and chaparral being in the same sentence, but obviously some chaparral was affected in Santa Barbara and also up the coast in Big Sur. You were just up in Big Sur, right?
Yes. I was asked by the Tassajara Monastery. It's a Zen monastery up, I guess, about 9 miles east of Big Sur. And it was a remarkable experience. What they asked me to come in for with a number of other experts, not that I'm an expert in much, but that's the definition anyway, or the label. So they ask us to assess the potential damage in the future for flooding and that kind of thing, which will be significant. And the thing that I was impressed with there, I was there for 4 or 5 days. We sat down at the table. The spirit of collaboration, the spirit of learning, was so dramatically different than what happens in San Diego County. And what really was made clear to me by what was going on at the table there at Tassajara, you know, there's two ways you can approach things. When you hear something that bothers you or there's some situation that's impacted you, you can go down two paths. You can go down what we like to call maybe the learning path or the open-minded path, and you're asking things like, you know, what don't I know? What assumptions am I making? Do I have any biases? And is there something influencing what I'm thinking that really isn't sound? That's the productive path, and that's what I saw at Tassajara, at the monastery there. The other path is a judgment path. What's wrong with this guy? I'm the one that's right. I know exactly what to do. And what's wrong with these people? Why don't they see the way I see things? And it's their fault, your fault. It's a blame game. And you read that in the papers every single day about the fire situation. It's the fire department's fault. It's the environmentalist's fault. People need to look in the mirror for a change. And they need to ask, what is it about me that's preventing a solution to this problem? And that's not what's going on presently with the situation in San Diego. I'm hopeful that the Planning Commission now is taking this in a holistic viewpoint and going to go down that pathway of the learning pathway, not the judgment pathway.
Yeah, there's no reason why these types of discussions need to be polarizing. No reason at all.
No, because everybody wants to protect life and property. I think most everybody would like to preserve the natural environment. There are some people that emote and say, let's just burn it all and get rid of it. But there's extreme positions everywhere. I'm not against prescribed burns if they're done properly. There's areas where you can do a strategic prescribed burn or possibly a fuel break by communities in strategic place where we know fires always run. And you can create situations where you can deal with these wind-driven fires on the flanks if you have done these strategic burns. But you don't just go out there like the Board of Supervisors has been recommending, just burn it all over and over and over. That's not the answer. You can't do that anyway. There's not enough money. It's going to destroy the natural environment, cause all those other problems. Why not put your money where it's going to have the most impact? And that's strategically placed prescribed burns in certain areas and fire safe these communities.
If you're just joining us, this is Tree Huggers International on KBZT, FM 94.9. I'm Tommy Howe, and joining us today is Rick Halsey, director of the California Chaparral Institute and a member of the San Diego Regional Fire Safety Forum, as well as being a Type 2 wildland firefighter and the author of Fire, Chaparral, and Survival in Southern California. Website for the California Chaparral Institute, pretty easy, californiachaparral.org. That's C-H-A-P-A-R-R-A-L. As you like to say, Rick, 1P and 2 R's.
1P, 2 R's.
CaliforniaChaparral.org. Real quickly, let's talk about some of the stands of chaparral along the Central Coast or elsewhere in the state that might have been affected by some of the fires earlier this year, whether it's in Big Sur or Santa Barbara or otherwise. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of some areas that really might have been damaged or some areas that escaped damage?
The fires up in the Santa Cruz area and the Big Sur area, most of those areas hadn't burned for 30 years. So the system can recover quite nicely. I'd like to have seen some of those areas not burn because old growth chaparral in excess of a century is really remarkable stuff. You can see these old growth manzanita stands with these giant red plants that have trunks the size of your waist. There's a really beautiful resource value there. Most of those are gone now because of all the fires. But that said, a 30-year fire return interval is okay. And that's what happened in the fires up in Santa Barbara recently. But as you come down further down the coast, it gets drier and drier and drier. And the ignitions that are caused by people, almost all these fires are people caused. What's happening is there's too many fires. And so as you move further up north, there's more moisture, and that's the number one variable determining whether a fire is going to run, is what we call fuel moisture. So if you have a lot of moisture in the vegetation, it's just not going to carry a fire. But down here, it's drier, so hence more fires, whether it's grass, shrubbery, or trees.
The Gajito Ranch is mentioned on your website.
Yes.
And that's an area in North San Diego County, and it's in a process where it's coming out of long-time private ownership. It might be going into some different type of ownership. There's been some talk of development there. Can you talk a little bit about the chaparral resources at Gajito Ranch and how they'd be impacted by? Basically, that area's never been developed.
Well, there's a misnomer about that ranch. It's been repeated over and over that they did the right thing. They allowed cattle grazing and that saved the ranch, et cetera, et cetera. That's just not true. The entire ranch has burned in these fires that have occurred in the last 5 years, except for a few patches here and there. And some of the grazed areas burned as well. In fact, some of the areas near the Gajito Ranch burned so severely that were grazed, barely stubble on the ground. There's nothing there but sand because the fire, the Witch Creek fire, was so intense. And at some point, it was more of a wind fire than just a fire. And the wind event was just horrible. So we don't know what's going on in the ranch. They're very tight-lipped about what the potential is. But a lot of the areas there that were protected because of the way the wind shifted or whatever are still relatively intact that didn't burn. But it wasn't, you don't protect chaparral and you don't protect natural environments by letting loose herds of goats and special chaparral-eating cows, which the ranch spokesman said that they had. You don't save something by destroying it. I mean, I heard that about towns when they bombed them in Vietnam. I mean, you just, what you've got to do is look at the whole picture. So, yes, grazing and goats, I dare say, in disturbed habitats that have already been destroyed can be used to keep the grasses and such that are already there from growing and can reduce the fire hazard. But you don't put those animals in virgin chaparral or sage scrub. They've done that, unfortunately, in Scripps Ranch on the buffers. They've completely destroyed big bands of coastal sage scrub and recovering chaparral when what they should have been doing was focusing on the buildings. So there's a misnomer also that before we were here, there were elk and all sorts of grazing animals that kept all these shrubs under control. In fact, at a meeting I was at, there was a resident near Bernardo Mountain that said that Bernardo Mountain chaparral that burned in the Witch Creek fire, shouldn't have been there because in the old days, the elk would have eaten it. In the old days, since none of us are here, it's hard to say exactly what was going on. But scientifically speaking, it's pretty clear that there were hundreds of miles, thousands of acres of contiguous shrublands in various areas. And that's a natural condition. So what we need to look at is not so much what we think was going on 5,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago, but what we need to do, again, to keep our communities fire safe and to preserve landscapes that we love, like Rancho Gajito. And unfortunately, that was to be purchased and developed into a state park, and it was passed by the state legislature, but Governor Reagan vetoed it. And that was, I don't know how many years ago that was. But so now we've got a situation where we still want to protect it. And we've got a very aggressive spokesperson out there that seems to enjoy making rather extreme statements about cattle and we're going to develop it whether you like it or not kind of thing. And it's not particularly helpful.
You made a visit up to the Cleveland National Forest very, very recently. Was that in the southern Santa Ana Mountains in Orange County?
Yes. Basically above maybe Corona, Temecula area.
And what did you find when you were up there?
Well, first of all, let me say, fuel management, and I don't like to use that word when we're talking about vegetation because everybody just thinks all vegetation is fuel, and that's a bad way to look at it. because everything's fuel, including your house. But fuel management properly done is important. Unfortunately, the way that it's dealt with now is the Forest Service and a lot of federal agencies are required to treat so many acres per year, whether they're good acres or bad acres or whatever. Now, what's that mean? Well, good acres means it'll make a strategic difference to save lives and communities. Bad acres are, well, let's just burn this so we can meet our quota. And with the budgets you've got a lot of situations where you've got to spend the money or you're not going to get it next year. So you've got a land management agency, the U.S. Forest Service, who is under pressure constantly by politicians to do something, do something, do something. And what's happened is there are fuel treatments that are being conducted right now that are not necessarily a good expenditure of public funds. They're destroying very valuable natural resources. And yesterday I was up west of, I think, Temecula, and it was about 4 or 5 miles north of Ortega Highway. And there was a really remarkable stand of manzanita chaparral there. And interestingly enough, there was a picture of it on a recent journal that the Native Plant Society put out last year. Well, they ran a giant brush-crushing masticator, they call it, through this entire patch. And all that's remaining now is ground-up leaves and branches. And it's a giant scar on the landscape. And it was done presumably, I don't know because I haven't gotten all the information yet, but it appears to have been done to protect this tree plantation of Coulter pines and some mutant hybrid pines that they had put up there. Because there was this whole, and there still is, an effort to, let's reforest this landscape. Let's get rid of those evil shrubs that aren't supposed to be in there in the first place. They planted a million trees plus in the San Gabriels back in the 30s because they couldn't understand why there weren't any trees up there. Well, that was East Coast ecology. All those trees are either dead now or they from drought or fire, and that whole attitude has been slowly eroded away. But this little tree plantation was probably part of that whole paradigm of let's get trees out there. And I love trees, but you know, you've got this unnatural setting, so it looks like what happened was that they did this fuel modification to protect this
They removed the natural species in favor of the imported species.
Well, the Coulter pines are native up there, and there are groves of them, and they're really beautiful. But they're amongst the chaparral. That's the natural way that the system works. If you're a land manager, you've got to manage the land. If you've got a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So whether it needs it or not, let's go ahead and do it. And this particular project, it does two things that are bad. It destroys a natural resource that is priceless. And secondly, it's a horrible public relations faux pas. Because responsible fuel management, because it's an important tool. But if this kind of thing is conducted and the public sees this kind of thing and it's done in a way that's not explained or seems to be done in a way that just seems to be so capricious, people are going to lose all support for any of these things because they're seeing it as a destruction of the landscape unnecessarily. There's a community above Corona, and they were going to put it right up against the forest. And the Forest Service got together with them and some other federal agencies and said, look, let's do this right. And you know what they did? They put the golf course next to the forest. And they put the houses away from the forest. There's wonderful people in the Forest Service and planners that know exactly what to do. People get together and they can create communities where basically when a fire comes, you sit in your living room and you have a cocktail and watch the fire go by. That's the way we should design communities. And we can do that. But what happens, there's this disconnect between the amount of money you've got, because millions of dollars have come into Southern California to do this fuel management. Why not create permanent solutions in older communities that are not safe in terms of fire? There's not a lot you can do in certain ones, and some you're going to have to do a little, maybe more fuel management than vegetation management than you would normally want to do. But there's a lot of ways you can create permanently fire-safe communities that you just do the problem, fix it once, low interest loans to get these shake shingle roofs taken care of, or help people understand the palm fronds have got to be taken off, or take that Mexican fan palm out of there. That can be done now so you don't have to continue to go back over and over and over to try to do these fuel breaks that may or may not have any impact. So you got to do a cost benefit analysis. What's the cost of this and what's the benefit? If the benefit doesn't exceed the cost, why do it? And that's the case, I believe, for this fuel management project I saw yesterday. It was a waste of taxpayers' money. The only people who benefited was the guy who had the grinder. And it's a bad call all the way around.
and a masticator was used. And yes. So basically what you said is what's left is slash is what it sounds
well,
like.
Well, it really is. It's ground up. It looks horrible. And that's what it does. And that's what you need to do in some places where you want to create a firebreaker or whatever. And there's places you can do that. And it makes me ill when I see it. But there are some situations near communities, again, that you might need to do that because some communities weren't originally planned properly. But not in the middle of the wilderness. And unfortunately, this area was not designated wilderness, and that's probably what we need to do. Just down the canyon from where this site is was where the last grizzly bear in Southern California was shot. 1908, I believe. Why not make it a national monument to celebrate an animal that we don't even know much about anymore? We know it's on the flag. That's about it. And I don't want the chaparral to end up like the grizzly bear did. People say, well, that's ridiculous. There's so much chaparral all over the place. Well, that's what they said about grizzly bears. That's what they said about sage scrub. There's not much left of the sage scrub, and the grizzly bears are gone. And so this attitude, we need to manage things for whatever reason other than preservation, really needs to be reexamined. And the multiple use perspective of the national forests, it's an anachronism that's really got to go, especially the forest, Southern California forests. We got to look at these things as national chaparral recreation areas. They're here for human beings to enjoy and for the habitat that's left for the animals to survive in. They're not for power lines. They're not for dams. They're not for invasive fuel breaks because there's not going to be much left anymore. And so that's got to be reexamined. It really does. We don't use them for lumber. We don't use them for grazing. We use them for all of us to enjoy the natural environment. And that's got to be the new way to look at these things.
Clean water.
Oh, clean water. Yeah. It's not a giant mountain of fuel that's only there to destroy life and property. And that's what, with this drumbeat, with flags waving and shouts being heard in all corners of the county here and on the front page of the newspaper, we've got to do something about this evil chaparral. This is where the fires are going to be because it hasn't burned in 30 years. You know, why not make those areas, instead of highlighting them as places of hazardous vegetation, why not say, you know what? These are hazardous development areas. Let's stop putting houses out there instead of looking at this like a vegetation issue. Sit back and look at the whole picture.
And stop applying malicious intent to something that grows there naturally.
Well, yeah. And with the malicious intent, it may not be there naturally anymore. You can get a good view of what it may turn into is if you go out to Riverside County along the 215 and look east in those hills there between Lake Elsinore and Riverside. There's nothing but weeds anymore. There's a couple green patches. But those hills have been burned so many times, over and over and over. There's nothing left. And that's the trajectory we're heading toward. The chaparral native plant communities, they're intrinsically valued in and of themselves. And I don't need to know how much water they give us or how much they make the climate better, or how much they prevent erosion, because they do all those things, how much recreational area and deer people can hunt in them. You could put dollar figures on that. I guess you could put dollar figures on the tourism that it attracts too, I suppose, and the mountain bikes that people buy to go ride in there and the hiking equipment. But essentially, if you start looking at things on a monetary value like that, it takes you down a path I don't think we want to go. Pretty soon this chaparral is, oh, well, you know, it's actually much more valuable as a biofuel. Let's grind it up and make biofuel out of it. And there's people right now that are suggesting that. The only thing stopping them is there's too many rocks out there. They don't have the equipment to be able to do that yet. And there are some environmental laws that are painted as evil by a lot of people that are actually there, and they've protected a lot of these open spaces. It has tremendous value to human beings in and of itself, and it does have ecosystem services that it provides. But that's I think, in the final analysis, is not really what's going to make us feel like we need to protect these things. I think we have to value them in and of themselves and appreciate the spiritual and emotional values they provide.
The California Chaparral Institute, you have any events going on? Are you going to be giving any talks anywhere?
Well, I'm going to Palm Springs next week and Palm Desert, I think, the following week. I do have a little event and news page on my website, so that'd be a good place if you want to come hear me. But I just talked, you know, of all places, to the Palomar Succulent and Cactus Society last week. Here was a room of about 60 people, all retired for the most part, before my presentation, these folks are up there at their table showing these succulents and these cactuses. One of these things was 100 years old in a little pot. You know, and what really impressed me was the passion that they had for these living things. The joy that they exhibited by just explaining how wonderful these things are. Does anybody know the name of this? And, you know, when they go out in their backyards, I ask them, how many of you have greenhouses where you raise succulents? And they all raise their hands, and they find so much joy. You know, you hear about people taking dogs and cats to hospitals, people that are ill or whatever. It makes them feel better. It extends your life. If you get connected in a way to the natural environment like these people at that meeting, it's got to tack on 10 years on your life. You know, instead of scurrying down the freeway worried about the meeting, if you can just sort of cast over to your left or your right and see these green hillsides and say, boy, that's pretty cool. I mean, you can physically feel the shift in your body. You really can. We can think a lot of things that keep ourselves healthy. And I think if we have a positive attitude about the environment and not an attitude of fear, which is where a lot of people are coming from, part, in fact, because of all this bad publicity that nature's getting these days, I think it'd be a better place. I want to read to you a news item that was in the newspaper here. And I'll just read the whole thing. It says, the forest fires in the mountains of this county, which have been raging for the past 2 weeks, are the worst fires known here. Reports today from Palomar Mountain give graphic descriptions of the great devastation in that beautiful park. Men and women have been fighting fire day and night, many going 2 or 3 days without food or sleep. And it goes on and talks about deer, snakes, and mountain lions have been driven down in the settlements. And it talks about how the Cuyamaca Peaks are being devastated. And we see how the pine, cedar, and oak trees have been mown down or destroyed by fire. 5 square miles. This is 1899. People think this Cuyamaca fire that happened in 03 with the cedar fire was a terribly unnatural event. Well, here's a fire 100 years before. What we have to look at is the long history and not just look at the last 3 minutes. There's going to be big fires in this county and in California, and they're always going to occur whether we checkerboard the landscape and destroy it or not. One of the questions was raised the other day at this meeting to help set up the Planning Commission study group that's going to look at this question. And they asked me, what would you do? What's your primary purpose here? And I said, the primary purpose I have, and I would like to see this panel or committee look at, is the question. Question is, how do we protect lives and property and preserve native ecosystems? I'm not so interested in all the answers, because when you ask the wrong question, like, for example, how do you stop these big fires? You're presuming a lot of things already. You're presuming you can. We don't want to go there, because all that's going to end up is in a dead end. Let's look at the question and then go down the learning path, take all the ideas, put the ego at the door, and kind of look at it in a way like, let's learn together and create a plan that we can all get in touch with in order to preserve the environment and the communities that we love in San Diego County.
Rick Halsey from the California Chaparral Institute. I appreciate you making time to come by.
You're welcome.
CaliforniaChaparral.org, that's the website, CaliforniaChaparral.org. That's 1 P and 2 R's in Chaparral. A Fire, Chaparral, and Survival in Southern California, that is the second edition, correct?
Yes.
That's available in bookstores everywhere and, of course, online as well. Rick, we'll talk to you next time, pal.
Thanks.
Well, that's going to wrap things up for this week's edition of Tree Huggers International on FM 94.9. Many thanks again to Rick Halsey for dropping by to catch up and talk about his work with the San Diego Regional Fire Safety Forum and the California Chaparral Institute, and his work as an advocate of wise land management and advocate of the chaparral. If you'd like more information, check out the website for the California Chaparral Institute, CaliforniaChaparral.org. And chaparral is spelled C-H-A-P-A-R-R-A-L, 1 P, 2 R's. CaliforniaChaparral.org. The opinions and views expressed on Tree Huggers International do not necessarily reflect the opinions and views of the staff and management of FM 94.9 or Lincoln Financial Media, and as producer, I am solely responsible for this program's content. Questions, complaints, concerns, compliments, go ahead and email me at tommy@fm949sd.com. That's Tommy at fm949sd.com. And for more on Tree Huggers International and to hear previous editions of the show, go to the Tree Huggers International page at the FM 949 website at fm949sd.com/treehuggers. Or just go to the FM 949 homepage and click on the Tree Huggers International logo. Again, it's Tommy for Tree Huggers International on FM 949. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 5:30 with another take on natural science and environmental affairs in our corner of Southern California. Get ready for another edition of Nina Blackwood's New Wave Nation next on FM 949, and I'll catch up with you at 9 o'clock for Brunch with Bob and Friends. Have a great Sunday and a good week. Be well.